Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Hike. When it comes to the late 1960s, most Americans recall the version that's been written about in the history books, the period of immense social change, the turmoil of political assassinations, the summer of love, the election of Richard Nixon, the legacy of Woodstock. But the 1968 and 69 in which Mark Sloka's latest novel is based is only a distant cousin of what people think of today. Sloka's book, Brewster, is set in a small city in upstate New York, Brewster, where 1968 still feels a lot like 1964 or 65. It tells of the unlikely friendship between high school track star John Mosher and the school's rebel, Ray Capiciano, and the difficult home circumstances they both inhabit. Mark Sloka visited us in the studio on a recent stop in Milwaukee. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by mentioning that I finished this book at about 10:30 p.m. and it dawns on me that this is not the book you want to finish at 10:30 p.m. I felt like I had to go watch the Andy Griffith Show or something like that. It packs a punch.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I'll take that as a compliment. And Andy Griffith might make up for it. It's not an easy read, I guess. You know, it takes on some pretty dark territory. I mean, it's a book about friendship at bottom, but that friendship comes under a lot of pressure.
One of the things that hit me most in reading the book, and a lot hit me, is that it paints a much less romanticized picture of 1968 and 69 than we often are exposed to so many years later.
Yeah, I think it does. From the way I see it, I suppose, I think the 1960s weren't just one thing. They were two or three, depending on who you were, on the class you came from. You know, my kids are working class kids. So when Woodstock comes around, they don't go to Woodstock because they can't afford to go to Woodstock.
Or they went to Yonkers.
They go to Yonkers, which is almost as good as going to Woodstock, but not quite. Because, you know, they couldn't afford it. They didn't know that they'd let everybody in for free, or, you know, mom and dad wouldn't lend them the car, or mom and dad didn't have a car. So I wanted to write about the 60s and have the 60s happening around them. But it's as though they're hearing, you know, something happening at a great distance and they're just picking up bits and pieces of it.
Right. The Jimi Hendrix and Jefferson Airplane and Country Joe and the Fish, they're on the radio.
Absolutely. And, you know, somebody buys an album and they sit around all night listening to Blonde on Blonde or something and, you know, that's the 60s. Yeah, it's all there.
It seems like it's interesting to think of how the changing times were reflected differently in a place like Brewster. While not far away, such watershed things are going on. And that really, you know, it's like the same planet but different worlds.
Yeah, yeah. And I tried to tap into that. I think I have my narrator say sort of early on, you know, we saw them coming through, you know, these people with guitars on their backs, you know, and their thumb out, you know, waiting for a ride. But they kept going. They didn't stop in Brewster. Why would they? I think that's still true of Brewster today, but that's another issue. I think it must have been interesting for people growing up in places like Brewster to know that this is happening, that, you know, Watts is happening, that, you know, all kinds of things are occurring. But you're still in 1963 or 62. I mean, the racism, the whole nine yards is still occurring around you. You're in this box. But things are outside of that box are becoming more audible.
You live in Brewster today, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Did you grow up there?
I grew up around there, yeah. And then I bounced around. I mean, I lived in Chicago for a while and New York for a while and San Diego for a while, Prague out in Europe for a while. And God help me, I came back to Brewster with my wife and kids. You know, we come back around, I think, to places we know, for better or worse.
Well, I don't know exactly your age, but I'm wondering if your experience
–
so yeah, so you would have been
10,
11 around the time of Woodstock?
Yeah. I was – in a way, I think that was a real good thing for me because I was just on the outside enough that I was able to write about it, which I think is exactly where you want to be as a writer. You don't want to be in the middle. You want to be on the outside looking in. I think that's what most writers do, whatever they're writing about.
Aside from setting, what sparked this story for you?
Coming to terms with my own past, with my family history to a great extent. You know, my parents were Czech refugees. My mother was pretty much broken by the time I was 10. I didn't actually realize until I finished the novel that what I'd managed to do unconsciously was sort of cut myself in two for the sake of the novel. That is, there's a younger brother, idealized brother who dies. The older brother lives on in the shadow of that death. I didn't have an older brother, but I had an idealized younger self that died as far as she was concerned. And I spent the next 20 years standing in front of her saying, I'm right here. I'm the same person. And she couldn't see that. And I think so there was a lot of kind of heavy lifting that this novel needed to do. And it came at the time when it came. And I wrote what I did.
John is your narrator.
Yeah.
And his mother was broken due to the death of this older sibling. And also, it seems like due to some, I guess the word is survivor's guilt from.
Absolutely. My parents were not camp survivors, but they survived their own horrors. You know, my dad had to cover the hangings as a 21-year-old journalist in Brno, Czechoslovakia. And what that did to him, I'll never know completely, but it was just buried away. Anyone who lives through a 7-year period like that is going to have some ghosts. They had more than their share, I think.
What is the significance of John's telling this story so many years later? Is this you? I mean, do you see yourself not necessarily as John throughout the book, but in the place of John telling the story as an adult processing this stuff?
I mean, John is autobiographical to a great extent. I mean, and sort of mom in the book is based on mom and life, and the character of Ray Capiciano, his friend, is a kind of a combination of two very close friends that I had when I was growing up. I was interested in what I think of as decency under pressure. I mean, these are both decent kids at bottom, and they're under ungodly pressure, which is not of their own making, that they don't deserve. But somehow their friendship, for a time at least, is able to provide some sort of a sanctuary for each of them. And I guess I've always been interested in the notion of justice. I mean, it's a recurrent thing for me, which of course feeds into the 60s as well. Sure. All of these things are coming together, and they allowed me to sort of explore what is just and unjust in family dynamics, you know, how friendship can help with the injustices and so on, yeah.
The friendship between them, really, they get things out of that friendship that they would have expected under other circumstances to get from family.
Yeah, yeah, and each of them in their own way can't get it from family. I mean, they're coming from essentially abusive relationships, each in their own right. And the third character in the book, Karen, who ends up being sort of the love interest for Ray Capiciano, is in some ways the strongest character in the book. But that's also because she can be. She comes from actually a normal family. But yeah, I mean, they're both coming from – they're both broken in different ways. And in a sense, I guess if the metaphor is like a broken bone, I mean, the two of them form one whole for a time being. Somehow that spoke to me. That was necessary for me.
Well, and the other thing about Karen as a character is it would have, I imagine, been very easy to fall into the cliche that Karen would have come between them. But so strong is this friendship that John essentially cedes Karen willingly to Ray.
Yeah. I mean, it's that kind of a friendship. And I also think he kind of recognizes an unstoppable force. I mean, these are two people. They're young, but that's fine. They're young people who are meant to be together. And I think John is just intelligent enough and maybe generous enough as a friend to recognize that. And also, he doesn't want to jeopardize the one good thing that he has in his life, which is really his relationship with Ray. So yeah, I tried very hard to sort of make Karen a character who sort of invites the stereotype and then destroys it. I mean, she looks like some hippie cheerleader, but that's until you talk to her and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, you know, there's a whole lot more going on to this in this person. Hopefully I got that right.
And given everything that is happening to these, you know, I want to call them kids on one level. I want to call them young adults on one level, maybe just people. It's amazing how much of their innocence still exists even to the very last moment of their childhood as portrayed in this book.
I'd like to think so. I mean, I wanted it to be that way. It's, you know, decency under pressure, innocence under pressure. I mean, I think the two sort of go together. I mean, these are – I mean, Ray, for all of his – I mean, he's the bad boy. He's the – you know, he's the kid who gets into fights, into a lot of fights. I think most of us have known somebody like that at some time. But what I wanted to do was create a character who is at bottom fundamentally decent and has been given this thing to contend with, as you know, because that's how life works. I mean, you know, the bad stuff doesn't just happen to bad people. It happens to whoever. And how we deal with the things that we've been handed is kind of what makes us who we are.
The story is framed in some large part by John's involvement on his school's track team. And there's a – I hate to use the word obvious, but I'll use obvious metaphor in his improvement in running races, but ultimately the pain of running races.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting about track because, I mean, I ran track and I think it was a good way of sort of inflicting pain on yourself, which is probably what I was trying to do out of some sense of guilt or anger or whatever it is. And John is very much in that camp. But I also think that the track spoke to the 60s. In the late 1960s, it was sort of a – it was the go-to sport for you know, the kids with an attitude, the rebels, the kids who weren't going to take a lot of stuff from the football coach yelling at them.
It's pretty egalitarian in some
it's
ways.
It's really egalitarian and very individualistic. I mean, to a fault sometimes. You're alone a lot when you're training. And so I sort of tapped into that because it was – that's where guys like John went in the late 60s.
And you know, obviously we don't want to give things away, but there's one point, the nightmare that John has about running really stuck with me even after so many other things happened in the book. Just this this image of him running and there being no one there, and you know, essentially to me it seems like the understanding that life goes on whether or not there's an audience.
Yeah. Well, it's that, and I also think somewhere underneath it all, I mean, the ideal metaphor is the kind that doesn't call attention to itself, right, and where you can't sort of line up everything. But it does occur to me that one of the things about running track is that he's trying to escape. He's trying to run away from all the things that he's had to deal with, but he's going in a circle. I mean, when you run track, you go in circles. And I actually had in an early draft of the book, I had him say something along the lines of, you know, I was better at coming around to where I'd started than anybody I'd ever met. And that's kind of the trap he's in. It's like, you know, and Ray, who's an abused kid, comes home every night and he's going in circles.
Right. Ray is obviously running or trying to run.
But he is trying to run and he can't because he's held back by his younger brother who he loves, you know, and so he's going in circles. So it seemed to fit.
Do you blanch at the idea of men's fiction?
No. I mean, I don't – you know, even like young adult fiction, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what that is and where the line is. I didn't write this as a young adult book, and then people started saying, oh, you've written a good young adult book.
So I was surprised at that. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I did. I wrote a book for adults that just happened to be about 17 and 18-year-old kids. I've met, you know, 50-year-olds who are children, and I've met, you know, 15-year-olds who are really not. And I know that, yeah, you're younger when you're 15 than 50. But, you know, I just talked to a great bunch of kids out here at Nicolet High School, I guess it is. I mean, they're terrific, terrific kids. And some of them were kids and some of them really weren't. And so in the same way I feel about sort of men's fiction or women's fiction, I mean, for some reason, more of my readers seem to be women. But maybe that's because more women are reading fiction now. I don't know the answer to that. I would think that this is a book that would talk to men. I would hope that it's a book that speaks to women as well. I mean,
friendship is friendship, really.
That's kind of how I would, and love is love. And you know, the hardship that we have to overcome is universal. So
it's interesting hearing you talk about talking to younger readers.
Yeah.
It's interesting just thinking, you know, I'm some years out from being a teenager and understanding all the things that, you know, as we were processing them then, how they line up with our understanding of them today. Does it surprise you how younger readers relate to what's happening in this book?
I guess it would be sort of, I don't know, self-deprecating or something to say it surprises me. But honestly, it doesn't because, first of all, I think there's a certain nostalgia among a lot of kids today for, you know, for the late 1960s, for the era before computers, before cell phones, before all the rest of it, because it seems purer, simpler. And I think it was in some ways. You know, though both of those words are kind of tricky, like pure, really? How? Simpler? Maybe unmediated is kind of a fancy word for it. I mean, you were kind of in the moment instead of
– less self-conscious.
Less self-conscious. You know, you couldn't take a selfie. I think it's a story about if I got it right, and that's really not for me to say, but if I did – then it's a story that speaks to friendship and friendships that form when you're 17, like love that happens when you're 17 kind of tends to burn very hot. And that's a kind of very privileged place for me to be as a writer and to try to get that right without sentimentalizing it, without romanticizing it in some way. So ideally it'll speak to – as it seemed to today. I mean the students seem really receptive. It'll just speak to something they know, something that they've experienced – in a book that's not talking down to them.
Do you see Brewster, the place today, any differently for having set fiction there and kind of recreated the Brewster of your youth?
Brewster, I mean, I make jokes about it being the Paris of Putnam County. It's a rough little place. It's got sharp elbows. It's still very conservative in certain ways that are not so great. It's a kind of a pocket, and I think it was very much a pocket in the 1960s. Things were happening outside, but Brewster wasn't part of them. I expected to get hear a lot of stuff from local Brewsterites, and in fact, it's been the opposite. I mean, they actually – I've had a lot of older people who've lived in Brewster for many decades come up to me and say, man, you got it right. And I was really flattered by that. I thought, okay, thank you. That's because it's not the kindest portrait. And for them to be able to say you got it right is kind of selfless as well. So that's neat.
Well, it's good, powerful stuff. Mark Sloka, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Sloka's recent novel is called Brewster, published by W.W. Norton. He lives in Brewster, New York, and stopped by the Lake Effect Studio on a stop in Milwaukee last month. That's all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you joining us once again today. Hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We are your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up in just about an hour's time, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, keep listening because it's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.